Coming to you from inside the hippopotamus we got for Christmas, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa. And I'm the only one who uses her actual name on this show.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it would be confusing otherwise. It's already confusing.
Hi.
Don't worry about it.
I'm Hannah.
Also Hannah. I'm also Hannah.
I am not Hannah.
Also, welcome to the Liberal Arts, a podcast also known as Two Hannahs and a Baby.
What?
Insulted, but I'm laughing too hard.
So welcome to our All Fun Facts, All Fun Facts mini-episode. We are so glad to have you here. We have so many fun facts for you.
Lots of facts. Five. And lots of fun.
You had four yesterday, what happened?
I have five now, but you said you only had like two, so that's seven.
I have Cleo? Three and a half.
Okay, great, we have so 10 and a half fun facts for you.
Fun.
I feel like we should do this taking turns, and you two should go first.
Okay.
I guess I have, like, almost half of these now. All of mine are connected is the thing. So
go for it.
So what happened was, the day before Christmas, I wanted to know the origin of a word, and so I Googled it. And then I fell down a Wikipedia hole for about 2 days. Maybe three? Yeah, going on three. Anyway, I'm not out of this Wikipedia well yet, and I've already got a tabletop RPG campaign going and a lot of fun facts, so this is going to be real kind of one thing links to another, because that's how Wikipedia works.
Okay.
But, so what started this is I wanted to know about the word Yule, because you hear it in, you know, Christmas music and stuff, Yule time, and I was like, what is that word, and how is it different from Christmas, and why do we use them interchangeably, and all that kind of stuff?
You're talking about Y-U-L-E, Yule,
yes,
right?
Yes, Yule. Okay. Yeah. And so it turns out that this actually became really interesting. So Yule is the old kind of, I don't want to say Viking, because that's a rather late term, but like...
Norse,
Yeah, I guess Norse celebration of the solstice, and they basically had a time period where, I guess what we would call December is almost called, like, the time before Yule, and January is the time after Yule.
Really?
Yeah. And so it was really associated with the gods, like, they were sometimes referred to as, like, those... of, like, they belong to Yule, basically. I don't know. There's some stuff about the gods there. But it was this big festival celebration. There would be sacrifices and stuff like that, because that's how they did celebrations back then. But it's also where the word jolly comes from. So that was my kind of fun fact I pulled out of it, was that, when, you know, you usually hear the word jolly in association with Santa Claus or Christmas and things, and that's because it literally comes from the same word as Yule does. So jolly is a Christmas word.
What's that root?
It's J-U-L. Jewel.
Jewel. Or if you're Scandinavian, it's Yule.
Yeah.
Yule.
Okay, Jewel. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm with you here.
Jewel-y. I feel
so
very
I just thought that was fun.
Today.
Jewel-y.
But not July.
I'm feeling very Jewel-y. Yeah, because July comes from Julius Caesar, yeah?
Yeah, yes. That's right, yeah. So that was the first step in my long spiral down. But I feel like I should let y'all take turns.
Go ahead, Cleo.
So, my first fun fact also has to do with Christmas.
Hey!
And it basically is the fact that Santa Claus didn't always wear red.
Okay.
So he has a wardrobe.
Yes, sometimes he was portrayed as wearing blue.
Really? I was expecting green, but blue?
Blue?
Green or brown or something.
Yellow.
White?
Yellow? Really?
And sometimes he was portrayed wearing a three-cornered hat.
Okay, who is portraying him like this?
Like a tricorn? Like a pirate hat?
Yeah, Yankee like, Doodle Pirates of the Caribbean kind of dude. What, yes. Who's drawing him like this?
This is the summer Santa Claus for the Southern Hemisphere.
Once upon a time, there was no established way of portraying Santa Claus. So sometimes he would wear blue, and sometimes he would be happy, and sometimes he would look really scary.
Well, a question. Were all of those Santa Claus, or were they kind of like the other figures that have made up? Like, no, Santa Claus. Because you got, like, St. Nicholas, and you got, like, Christopher, and you got, like...
It was Sinterklaas. Okay. The Dutch referred to him as Sinterklaas, which was their nickname for St. Nicholas.
Yes.
Father Christmas. That was just... There was no established way of portraying him, and every place had a little different way of doing it. So, in the Dutch Christmas tradition, apparently, if you are naughty, you don't get coal in your stockings. Santa Claus comes and sticks you in a bag and his elves beat you up.
Okay. I thought we were going to get into some Krampus things, but I haven't heard of that one.
The modern image that we have of jolly old Saint Nick comes from a Coca-Cola advertising campaign.
Yay, American capitalism!
Why aren't there polar bears involved then?
I don't know.
That was a whole different ad campaign.
Yeah, but don't you want polar bears for Christmas to go together? Because I love polar bears.
I think polar bears go with anything. But,
True.
Yeah, polar bears are an every season kind of aminal.
Yeah.
Aminal?
Don't. You're such great aminals.
Do not at me.
Such good aminals. Love good. Those animals.
Good aminals. Anyway, I watched a whole video about this. PBS does these Origins of Everything videos, and I was watching. And they had one about why Santa Claus is red, so I'll post a link to it. It's really fun.
That's great.
Next?
Yeah, would you guys like to know about the Oyster Wars?
I would.
The what?
The Oyster Wars.
Is it a war between oysters?
Oysters.
Unlike the Emu Wars, which is a war between people and emus, this was not a war between oysters and
people.
Hold on. Hold up.
Stop there.
Yeah?
Okay, reset. Let's talk about the Emu War first, and then we can talk about the Oyster War later. You were just going to skip over that? Woman, who are you?
Oh, I thought everyone knew about the Emu Wars.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Look, you have another fun fact. We're up to 11 and a half.
All right. Give me a second. I gotta get my dates right, because I'm not certain about this. So, after World War I, in Australia, with the Great Depression, there was a lot of drought, so the government decided to do something about increasing wheat crops, and the government, like, promised to deliver some subsidies to help, and then failed to deliver on those subsidies. Wheat prices continued to fall. People were poor, economics happened, it was the Great Depression, everyone knows this bit.
Right.
But what everyone does not know about this bit was that one of the concerns about drought was that emus from the non-agricultural areas were moving into agricultural areas because that's where the food and water was.
Okay.
I'll remind you, it's Australia. Which is a terrifying deathscape at the best of times, but during a drought, it was even worse. So, the emu were moving onto farm territory, and the government thought, well, you know, we can't give money to farmers because we don't really have any, so at the very least, we'll send some military help to fight the emu. The thing about emus...
Sorry!
So, yes. they sent... the 7th Heavy Battery of the Royal Australian Artillery, commanded by Major G.P.W. Meredith.
They sent artillery
to fight emus?
Okay, here's
emus?
The thing about emu. They're insane.
Yeah, they're giant
also
birds.
Really difficult to kill.
Yeah, emus
okay?
are pretty evil.
They take a lot of bullets to kill. They're extremely hardy birds. They're hard to aim at because they're so fast.
I know what's going in our next campaign.
Oh no!
They're like, I'm sorry, this is just, I have Jurassic Park flashing in my head with raptors.
Listen,
no
joke, but emu are basically dinosaurs.
It's very true.
It's true. Okay, so the military attempted to fight the emus. Here's the thing. Emus, not stupid. Is it emu or emus? I've said
no. I don't know.
We're gonna, don't at me. They attempted to fight the emus, and the emus were not having it. So every time they tried to ambush the emu, they found that they might kill a few, but then the emu knew where they were ambushing them and would avoid the place later. And they were getting wise to their schemes.
Oh my gosh, they're evolving.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Did the emu ever go on the offensive?
They learned how to open doors. No, they didn't.
What? Don't do that to me. I believe you. I trust you, Hannah.
I'm so sorry. Oh, gosh. At one point, they got machine gunners involved and still...
I thought you meant the emu did.
And then
the emu grabbed a gun.
I'm just imagining him hopping around on one foot and holding a gun in the other.
Oh, Lord.
You know, I wouldn't put it past him. So they blamed a lot of things for their failure to shoot emus. They blamed inexperienced machine gun users, which I'll remind you, this was right after World War I, so...
Not unfair.
No, it was pretty unfair.
Pretty unfair.
People knew how to use machine guns. Like, we know what we're about. They theoretically, they were at one point killing 100 emus per week, but Major Meredith was known to exaggerate to make himself sound more successful than he was because he was fighting birds, for goodness sake. By 1932, they kind of gave up on it because, frankly... They were not killing many emus, the emus were outsmarting them, and it turns out a fence is a better, a tall fence is a better defense against the emu.
Oh my gosh.
I really want to
read. In addition to keeping out, dingoes and rabbits, so that's convenient.
So they built a fence.
They built some fences, and
it
worked better.
Is that why they built the rabbit-proof fence?
For the emu.
For the emus.
No, rabbits are also an invasive species in Australia. But,
yes.
No, they did not build it for the rabbits. Necessarily. Like, that it doubled as a also emu-proof. That's
my
first fun fact that I didn't plan on talking about today. I didn't do really any research on that.
Really want to read a memoir of the emu wars now.
Oh, there
are
books.
How have I never heard about this? Wonderful.
Dear Mother, day 42, the birds have learned to outsmart us.
Rissa, would you like to go?
Sure. I've got more stuff about North Smith if y'all are ready.
Oh,
so
yeah,
ready.
So the other thing that I was curious about is the 12 Days of Christmas. Because my mom mentioned, today starts the 12 Days of Christmas. This was 12 days before Christmas. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that the 12 Days of Christmas come after Christmas.
Yes, that is what I've heard,
which
too.
Which I'm correct about. So these days, the 12 Days of Christmas come after Christmas. They are the church... period called Christmas time. So before Christmas is Advent, after Christmas is Christmastide or Christmas time. And they end in January with the celebration of the
Three
Epiphany.
Kings Day.
Or the Three Kings Day, yeah. But it was like, why 12? And it turns out that this is actually also from Yuletide. So Yuletide was a 12-day celebration, which actually started on the 21st, the winter solstice. So it's a little different, but it still had that 12, and it was just kind of remade and Christianized. But I was still like, why 12? That's kind of a weird time to pick. And I never quite found an answer for why 12, but I did find one really funny description of the Yule Festival. In which a king made an edict about the Yule Festival. But this was a time when festivals were enforced, because the festivals were all about the gods, right? And if your people aren't worshipping the gods right, that could be bad for the entire country. So it was like, you have to celebrate Yule. It is a religious requirement for the good of the people. So one of the things you had to do was sacrifice a boar. So this is actually probably why we still eat ham on Christmas Day a lot, is actually because Yule was specifically associated not only with Odin, but with Freyr, one of the gods of prosperity, and he was associated with boar.
Hmm.
So you sacrifice a boar to Freyr, and then the description of how long Yule shall last was actually the king made an edict that everyone had to have a certain amount of ale, and that Yule lasted as long as the ale did.
Oh, that's awesome!
Which was apparently around 12 days if you did it right.
I was going to say, that's a very personal interpretation of Yule.
I just thought it was really funny.
At least there's some room for your religious freedom.
Yeah.
It went
I mean, if you want your ale to only last 3 days, that's fine.
You can do that. That's allowed.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm not sure this is exactly where the 12 days came from, but it was one of the first records we have of kind of standardizing the festival in any way. And I just think it's interesting, the idea of an enforced holiday in that kind of time period. But I just really love their measure of time via ale. Like, yes, please. Can we measure time that way? So yeah,
Hi, science here. Can we not?
You don't have to drink the ale. The festival will last forever.
No. I'm not talking about my personal drinking
Christmas
habits. I'm
music
about the fact
all year long. Science, oh, think gracious. Of it.
Oh my gosh, I hate everything. Do you want to go, Cleo?
Okay, so this is where we're going to get a fun fact and a half.
Yeah, I wanted to know about this half.
Basically, my fun fact is that as part of teaching English, I was talking to one of my students one day. She is from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I was asking her questions about her country and about the capital city and... The capital of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is Kinshasa.
Okay.
And in the course of this conversation, I learned that Kinshasa is larger than New York City.
Wow.
Wow, by area or by population?
By population.
Dang. Wow.
So New York City, within the last couple years, has had an estimated population of around 8.5 million. This is just New York City. It's not the greater New York metro area. Just New York City itself.
Okay.
Population of about 8.5 million. Kinshasa.
Which is insane in and of itself. That's more than the population of my entire state.
Kinshasa, I went looking and I found estimates from anywhere from 9 to 12 million people.
Holy crap.
That's a lot of people.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in the capital city. So, I just thought that was really fascinating, because I know when I think of giant cities, I don't automatically think of Africa.
Yeah. And
maybe we should.
Yeah, we totally should, because Cairo's even bigger. If you include the greater Cairo metro area, it has a population of 20 million.
Huh!
Dang. That is many.
That is a lot of people.
Now I want to look up Dallas. Sorry, no, I was just looking. Dallas has 1.3 million, and that's just very small.
Yeah.
Yeah, bro.
That's actually smaller than Nashville, I think, which is weird to me.
Still greater than the entire population of Montana, though.
Wait, so what you're saying is everything is not bigger in Texas.
Oh!
That is just Dallas proper, and not the entire metroplex.
Uh-huh.
Which is closer to 7 million.
Mm-hmm. Still smaller than New York City.
I mean, obviously.
Anyway, this sent me on a rabbit hole of map comparison. And I know we've talked before, Rissa, about the size in the U.S. comparative to size in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, the state of Texas is bigger than... What was it? You said Texas was bigger than... Like
I think England
Great
can
Britain.
Fit in there about 5 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The entire continental U.S. can fit in the continent of Africa.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Really?
I didn't know that.
I mean, it is a continent.
It is a continent, I know, but it's the U.S. is also part of a continent. So, I wasn't thinking of it in terms of land mass, and I ended up on this... article with a bunch of different maps that were like, here's one country compared to the continental U.S. Here is Alaska compared to the continental U.S. And guys, the world is a big place. That sounds really dumb, but I think a lot of times I just look at a map and never process how big land masses are The Congo, for example, covers like 7 states. Mm. It's huge.
We're not talking little bitty states, are we?
No, whereas, see if I can find it. It's like, you could just slap it in the Midwest and it would cover parts of Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Indiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, Nebraska, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Wyoming.
That's
a lot. Oh my gosh.
Like, not, you know, all of those states entirely, but it would cover pieces of all of them.
Yeah, I mean, you listed both Montana and Arkansas in there, so that's
a
big way.
It's huge, and Sudan is the same way. Like, if you slap it on the West Coast, it would cover portions of Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, Utah, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington.
Holy Hera.
Dang.
And that was before Sudan split into 2 countries, but still, it's, like, huge.
Yet another reason why talking about Africa as if it's one nation is dumb.
Yeah.
Is a dumb thing.
I had a coworker in high school from Sudan, and I made the mistake of asking him a question about South Africa. And I said, so in South Africa, do they do such and such too? And he goes, I don't know. I don't know the first thing about South Africa. So that's my fun fact. There are very large cities in Africa, like bigger than New York City. Just single countries are a lot bigger than I think we give them credit for. It's amazing.
A lot of that comes from map distortion.
It does come from map distortion. And just,
I mean, some of it does, yeah, but there's also, like, I don't know. Westerners have minimized Africa in their minds for centuries. When they found Great Zimbabwe, which is this massive city complex in Zimbabwe,
mm-hmm.
White people were so convinced that Africans could not possibly build this that they came up with all kinds of wackity theories.
The aliens helped them.
I mean, yeah, basically. They're like, this is obviously a lost tribe of Israel.
Oh my god. What?
This is a Persian colony of some kind, I can tell.
A Persian colony?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely ridiculous.
In Zimbabwe.
Oh, in Zimbabwe. I feel bad now because I'm going to talk about minutia.
Oh, please do talk about minutia.
Pretty entertaining minutia, but... Yeah, so now that we've talked about the emu wars, I guess it's time to talk about the oyster wars.
Oh, yeah. So you said this wasn't a war against oysters.
It was not, because oysters are delicious. And after the Civil War, people recognized that oysters were delicious. For a long time, they were kind of seen as a poor man's food, because anyone could just go and grab an oyster off Chesapeake Bay.
Question before we do this, have y'all eaten oyster? Because I haven't.
I have not either.
Are they really good? Because they look so gross.
Yeah, listen, they look like the flu, but they taste great.
Okay. One of these days.
Yeah, give them a try. You know, they're a weird texture, but they are delicious.
I think they would have to be fried. So that they don't
fried
look
oysters,
like the flu
also
anymore.
Delicious. They look like crunchy.
The crunchy flu.
The crunchy flu. this is the worst sentence I've ever said. Moving on. So after the Civil War, as they developed canning processes and railroads, there was a big boom in the sale of oysters. So demand started going up. Hmm. There was a point when Chesapeake Bay supplied almost half of the world's oysters. And because of that, there were a lot of people who wanted to make a buck off selling oysters. So this is important for knowing about the oyster wars. There are two kinds of oyster fishing. There's dredging, where you take a thing and you drag it along the bottom of the coastline in deep water, and tonguing, where you basically just hop out the boat in shallow water and pluck them up one by one.
Right.
So dredging requires more teams, like a larger crew and a bigger ship, but it is highly profitable. There was a time when you could dredge oysters in Chesapeake Bay and make 4 times what most Marylanders earned at the time. So, like, most Marylanders didn't earn more than $500 a year. Dredgers could earn up to $2,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Maryland and Virginia both outlawed dredging by 1879 because it was using up all of the oysters, right? And it was depleting the oyster population, and it was causing a lot of smaller tonguing operations to be to go out of business. And actually, the dredgers started creeping into the tongers' waters. Like, they started dredging in shallow waters instead, which was not good economically and just kind of rude, honestly.
I have a question. And then, you may not know the answer. How do oysters grow? How do they reproduce?
There's a lot of... Listen,
when a mommy and daddy oyster love each other very much.
There is actually a very interesting biology answer, but I only know, like, a third of it, so I'm not going to go into it at this time.
Okay.
Suffice to say, their shells develop. They do not... They're not, like, found, like, hermit crabs.
Okay. That was mainly my question, was how do they get the oyster in the shell?
The oyster is born in the shell and grows with... The shell grows with it.
Nice.
Yes. I don't even know if born is the right word, to be honest. Okay, anyway.
Hatched.
I don't know if they are in eggs. Anyway. Oh, yeah. So, in 1865, Maryland passed a law that required annual permits for oyster harvesting, only for residents. And, like... Hmm. Yeah, exactly. In Maryland waters. So, if you were from Virginia, you couldn't creep on over into Maryland waters and pluck oysters there. You had to have an annual permit, or you had to stay in Virginia waters. And this is what most people think of as the beginning of the oyster wars. So, people broke these rules all the time.
No.
Shocking. To the point where Maryland formed an oyster navy in 1868. And yes, it was called the Oyster Navy. What? To fight oyster pirates. The Oyster Navy was underfunded and largely ineffective because the oyster pirates were stronger and meaner and more aggressive and had better weapons. And oyster pirates were pretty terrible. They, like, killed people, they kidnapped immigrants for basically slave labor aboard their ships.
This needs to be a HBO series immediately.
Right? Seriously. In 1882, Virginia Governor William Cameron was so unpopular that he's like, you know what, I gotta do something big. So he led an expedition. This is Virginia, so they don't have an oyster navy in Virginia.
Okay.
But he did lead a military expedition to raid pirates at the mouth of the Rappahannock River.
Okay.
He was extremely successful. He was there personally, and he and his two ships and his crew... took down 41 pirates. They had 41 convicted pirates and captured 7 boats.
Wow.
Yes. His popularity sank, again later on, in the next year, so he tried again, and he failed, and he was so terribly unsuccessful that people wrote comic operas about it. The oyster wars kind of died down in the 20s because, get this, oysters are associated with alcohol. So you drink alcohol and you eat oysters. Mm-hmm. And guess what happened in the 20s?
Prohibition.
Prohibition. So the demand for oysters went down some. And also the Chesapeake started to get overfished and pretty polluted. Actually, these days they're trying to reintroduce oysters into the Chesapeake and Hudson Bays because they're excellent at filtering pollution out.
Cool.
Do not eat those oysters. They are full of toxins.
good to know.
Yes. But, yeah, fun facts. Anyway, that's my oyster war spiel. It's much better than the emu war spiel because I actually researched this bit.
I really just want, like Grissa said, an HBO series called The Nature Wars, where we just watch people fight animals or over animals. This is wonderful.
I would totally watch that series. I would watch that so hard. Rissa, it's your turn.
Sorry. I was so distracted by the idea of an oyster pirate navy. I was just, like, trying to figure out how could we make a TV show about this.
Pirates of the Chesapeake.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, goodness. If y'all want to skip back to North Myth with me, I've got a few more there.
Okay.
I do. Oh, I wanted to say, Stuff You Missed in History Class does an excellent podcast about this. I highly recommend it. We'll Ooh. Link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, here. I'd love to hear that. So, I don't know how much you guys know about Norse myth.
Almost nothing.
If I ask you, in the mythology of the Norse, where do the souls of those who die in battle go?
Valhalla.
Or,
I mean,
Folkvanger. Yes. So it turns out there are actually two different Halls of the Dead for those who have died in battle, making a total of at least three afterlife locations in the north of it. Valhalla is a great hall. Yeah. Well, you don't get to pick. The gods pick for you. So Valhalla is the Hall of Odin, and it's definitely the most well-known because it's associated with Odin and with the Valkyries and all that kind of stuff. But there is actually another Asgardian Hall of Dead Warriors called Folkvangr, which is it's not a hall so much as a field or a meadow that is ruled over by Freya, who is a goddess of love and other things like that. Freyr's twin sister. She's often compared to... I wouldn't compare her to Aphrodite. Like, she's over a lot of the same things. Love, beauty, fertility, but also war and death.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought that was really interesting that there is a second Valhalla that for some reason we never talk about.
So
I don't know why.
How do you get to one versus the other?
The gods choose. Like, they just pick.
So it's like... Odin's like, I don't know if I want this guy.
Basically,
Freya's like, I'll take him.
Basically, to get into either Valhalla or Folkvangr, you need to be invited by either Freya or Odin.
So is it like whichever one gets to you first?
I don't know. It just, we don't have a lot of written record, including Folkvangr. We have one thing that says that Freya decrees who shall have a seat in her hall. Half of the dead she chooses each day, and the other half does Odin have, it says. So
I like the idea of them.
They just kind of split, like, I just imagine them teaming off, team one, team two, team one, team two.
I like the idea of, listen, I know you like her, but, like, the Shield Maiden, she was too cool for you, Odin. I'm sorry, she's mine. I will trade you... six archers for her.
I'm imagining a Jack Sparrow, Davy Jones moment where it's like, how many souls is one worth?
So yeah, I thought that was interesting. I think one of the reasons that we don't hear about it as much is Valhalla comes up more in other myths and is also significantly more tied to the Valkyries and also to the amassing of armies on Ragnarok.
Does Folkvangr have, a warrior delivery service?
Like the Valkyries?
Valkyries?
The idea is that the Valkyries bring the souls to Odin and Freyr, who split them up. But then the Valkyries, because they, I believe, serve Odin, they kind of also go in Valhalla, whereas the people that they have brought up, which Freyr receives... Like, the Valkyries aren't as associated with
Okay,
that.
I'm with you.
Some people have also suggested that Freya is a Valkyrie. Remember that this is myth, so there's, like, a 5 bajillion different versions that are all true, because this is a myth that has been passed down in lots of different places, and we only have a couple of written records and stuff like that. So, yeah, apparently both Odin, the Allfather, and Freya, which I thought this was just really interesting because she is a goddess... who rules over this land of warriors. The third, by the way, is Hel, and that's where everyone who didn't die in battle goes, especially those who died of sickness or famine or suicide, things like that.
That's chill. That also sucks.
Yeah. You go to Helheim, which is on the opposite side of the cosmos from Asgard, and Hel is there, and everything sucks and is bad.
Okay.
Are there
All
exceptions
right. I kind
to
of...
this? Like, does your baby have to die in battle to go see Odin?
I don't know. To be honest, we don't have a huge we don't have lots of religious texts about what they believed in the afterlife. What we do have is the stories of Valhalla. We have the stories of Freya and Folkvangr, and we have the stories of Hel, the person, who is a female being that is Loki's spawn. Loki's spawn also include a giant wolf who will eat the sky, a serpent who encircles the world and eats its own tail, and an 8-legged horse. So...
Loki, your family is so dysfunctional.
Loki.
Yeah, but anyway, one of them is Hel.
Great.
I mean, at least three of those were by the same woman, if it matters. The other one was the other one was by a male horse, so there's that. Mythology.
So I find it interesting that Norse hell is a woman. I'm guessing that old phrase that says, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
Might be referring to hell, the person. Yeah. She's a lot like Hades, I would say.
That's Shakespeare, right? Would he be familiar with Norse myth?
Probably. I honestly don't know what all he had access to. He talks about Greek myth a lot. Yeah. Now I want to Google that for you. There's probably a lot of different places that could come from. But yes, the Norse hell person is a female being. I want to say woman, but she's not. It's not. She's not a human or anything like that.
Yeah.
And because she is of Loki, and her brothers include a dog and a snake, people. she's can be portrayed as less human than a lot of the other gods. But yeah, she was actually given rule over death from all nine of the realms. Yeah, kind of appointed as the ruler of a realm, which not a lot of the gods get their own realms. But hers is Helheim or Niflheim, and it sucks. So there's that.
Not all gods are given control of their own realms, but the ones that are apparently suck at it so bad.
Well, there was another god, Freyr, who was given a realm of Alfheim, the realm of the light elves, as a teething present.
What?
Oh, so good.
He could chew on elves?
No, it was just a present for him when he was a baby. They were just like, present for the baby child because he has teeth now. It's a realm of elves. Have fun.
Growing teeth is rough. Have a realm.
Yeah. Freya is actually more important than I imagined when I first got into Greek myth. I feel like you always hear about Thor everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think Freya is a lot better than Thor. He's the twin brother of the goddess of beauty and all that stuff. And he is also a god of prosperity and pleasure and happiness. And they're both fertility goddesses. Gods. She's a goddess. He's a god. Both fertility. Twins.
Rad. Cleo.
Yes. So my final fun fact is about women's suffrage.
Ooh.
That is fun.
Social responsibility, so fun.
Social responsibility. I watched a video this morning about the economic contributions of prostitutes to the Wild West.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's part of Adam's Ruins Everything, right?
Yes, and it's a really good video. It's such a good show. The way that women really helped to build towns through less than reputable means. But one result of that is because of the power and influence they often wielded in towns, the Wild West was the first place to grant women the right to vote.
It was Wyoming first, right?
It was Wyoming. So women got the national right to vote through the 19th Amendment in 1919, but in 1869, the state of Wyoming granted women the right to vote.
Nice.
Which is not an earth-shattering fact. I mean, science at least, you knew that already. I knew that was a thing, but it made me really, you know, watching that video, I was like, well, why did Wyoming give women the right to vote? So I got to looking and I found a couple different reasons. One is simply that they had no women in Wyoming.
What?
Well, the ratio of men to women was like 6-1.
Dang.
And so one of the reasons they passed women's suffrage was the hope that more women would come to Wyoming.
Did it work?
It did.
Nice.
Unfortunately,
like a question mark.
Unfortunately for many of the early proponents of women's suffrage in Wyoming, it did not work politically the way they wanted it to. One of the early proponents of women's suffrage in Wyoming was a Northern Democrat named William Bright. And William Bright was part of the Democratic Party, which in the North did not like the very anti-slavery focus of the Republican Party. They thought other things were more important. So things like stopping slavery, granting rights to freed slaves, weren't that big of a deal for Northern Democrats. And one of...
Not a great way to pitch your people.
No, and by this time the 14th and 15th Amendments had been passed, which granted voting rights to freed male slaves. And so some of the Democrats in Wyoming thought, well, you know, all the freed male slaves have voting rights. If they come here, they're going to outvote us. They're going to vote for Republicans instead of for Democrats. Lord. So we should give the women the vote.
Because white women will vote with us.
Yes.
Wow.
Yikes.
So the governor at the time was a Republican, and he opposed suffrage. So the Democrats...
Who?
So the legislature managed to get it passed. It was a mainly Democratic legislature. They managed to get suffrage passed. It became a law. And the women promptly went out and voted for the Republican Party.
Wow.
But it did lead to some really interesting political developments within Wyoming. Once they realized that this was not going the way they thought they did, the Democratic legislature tried to repeal suffrage. And the Republican governor vetoed that.
Yeah, I should hope so. Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
So women were granted the right to vote in Wyoming in 1869. In the next year, 1870, a woman named Esther Morris became the first woman ever to hold public office. I'm not sure if this is in the U.S. or in Wyoming, but she became a justice of the peace.
Yeah!
Nice.
And when Wyoming became a state in 1890... When they started the process of statehood, Congress told them that in order to become a state, you have to get rid of women's suffrage.
Ew.
Screw that.
Yeah. And Wyoming sent a telegram to Washington, which, according to one source I found, said there are two versions of the strongly worded telegram that told Washington that wouldn't do. They said either, we may stay out of the Union for 100 years, but we will come in with our women, or we will remain out of the Union 100 years rather than come in without the women.
Either way, one of those seems a little more succinct, but okay.
Yeah, either way. It's kind of a long telegram. But basically they said, if you want us as a state, you have to accept the fact that women vote in Wyoming.
Nice.
Take that.
So this was still 20 years before women everywhere were granted the right to vote. But because of their strong history of women voting, in 1924, the nation's first female governor, Nellie Taylor Ross, was elected to govern the state of Wyoming.
Good job!
Yay!
So, yeah, I just found that was a bit of another Wikipedia-like well for me, but
nice.
Cool things about true facts about Wyoming. There you have it. Those are my fun facts for the day.
I have one more as well.
Is it about another animal war?
It is not.
Is it about the opium wars?
Unrelated to everything we've talked about.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Did you guys know that there's a saint that's a samurai?
I did, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
But only did you show this to me? Did I show this to you? I don't remember.
I think it showed up on Tumblr around the same time for us both, because we follow, like, the same six
The same people.
but I think the artwork we saw about the samurai saint was made before he was beatified, but now he has been beatified, actually, in February.
Good job!
So, yeah. So, can I tell you guys about the Blessed Aegisthus Takayama Ukon?
Yes, please. Please.
I would love to hear more about this man.
Okay, so he was born in either 1552 or 1553. He was a daimyo, which is like a lord, you know, a sort of a noble guy slash warrior guy, like military nobleman.
Hello, I guess. I am a noble warrior guy.
Hello, it is I, a noble warrior guy. And a trained samurai as well. And he was, okay, I was very dumb. And I'm like, oh, what does this word mean? They said he was a Kirishitan, mm-hmm. which
Christian.
He's a Christian. That's all that means. That he and his family historically were Christians.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm like, what is this word? Clicking on it on Wikipedia. Oh, it just means Christian. Great job. Please, by the way, I apologize for my Japanese pronunciations. They are below weeaboo levels. They're just not good.
No.
So he was baptized when he was 11 or 12, along with his entire family. His father converted at that point to Roman Catholicism. But he didn't really live out his faith until he was later on, like in his 20s, because mm-hmm. After his coming of age ceremony, which was a ceremony given to all samurai, it spiraled out of control. Long story short, he had to duel someone.
What?
And yeah, he was very badly wounded and actually killed the other person in the duel. And he realized, huh, the way that my life is going is maybe not the way it should be going.
So hey, son.
Yeah, exactly. He rededicated himself to his faith and decided to live out the rest of his life as he always should have as in his mind as a Christian.
Wow.
So he and his father they worked under a daimyo named Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who, yeah, he was known as the second great unifier of Japan. He was a very powerful military commander who basically unified the disparate parts of Japan.
Nice.
But Hideyoshi was not very kind to Christians. So despite the fact that Ukon and his father and his family were fighting for Hideyoshi, they were also fighting for the rights of Japanese Christians, and Hideyoshi didn't like that. So he commanded all Kirishitan daimyos to give up their faith or forfeit their name, property, possessions, all of it.
Dang.
And Ukon said, I would rather give up everything. And he did. He was forced to leave Japan, give up everything he had. He was exiled to Manila in the Philippines. And because he was exiled, he fell ill and was dead within 40 days. Wow. So he's considered a martyr because he was forced to leave his home, and because of that, he died.
Wow.
So, yeah. He was beatified, like I said, in February of this year, so February 2017. And he is the patron saint of Japanese immigrants, persecuted Christians, and the University of Santo Tomas grad school.
Okay.
He was welcomed in Manila. They liked him there.
Nice. Yeah.
That's the story of, there's a samurai who's a saint.
That's awesome. Yeah, the history of Christianity in Japan could be an entire colloquium in and of itself. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, because I clicked on Hideyoshi's name, and, like, it said, like, he's important in the development of the history of Christianity in Japan. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Why? And he's like, because he ordered the execution of 26 Christians by crucifixion. And I'm like, oh gosh.
In the city of Nagasaki. Okay.
Oh, man. Really? So I would be interested in looking into that. I might do that for my next colloquium and pronounce more Japanese names poorly.
It's pretty cool. When the Catholic priests were expelled, the whole church pretty much had to go underground. And
gracious.
When they were finally allowed back in, you know, they thought they were going back into this place where no one knew, you know, they used to have the gospel, but they don't have it anymore, and we're going to have to start all over from scratch. And they set up churches, and people started coming to the churches going, hi, I'm a Christian. Are you a priest?
That's amazing.
And they were just like, what? I'm like, yeah, we're Christians. We've been hiding. Welcome back.
That's awesome.
Oh, so those are all of my fun facts. Would you like to finish this up strong there, Rissa?
Yeah, I guess I can. Mine aren't nearly as cool as that, though.
Oh, go ahead, anyway. I want to hear more about your Norse mythology.
Yes, Norse mythology is always cool.
So this one, the last two are kind of, they're about the same thing, basically. isn't technically about Norse mythology, but the most famous thing to be inspired by Norse mythology.
Avengers.
The superhero?
No. Wagner's Ring Cycle.
Oh!
Yeah, it's a series of four operas that tell some of the
Looney
most...
The soundtrack for Looney Tunes? I mean...
Bugs Bunny dressed as Valkyrie.
Oh, goodness. If you've ever heard The Ride of the Valkyrie... That's from the Ring Cycle, really famous song. Yes. That's from the Ring Cycle,
but only because of Looney Tunes.
Okay.
Hey, that's better than not.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you've heard it.
Some exposure to classical music in some form.
So, Wagner's Ring Cycle. I'm not going to try to pronounce it in German. The Ring of the Nibelung is what it translates to, but it's a series of four operas, and the last one, Götterdämmerung, actually, I don't know which one The Ride of the Valkyrie is from. It's probably from the one called The Valkyrie, which is the second of the four. Götterdämmerung is the one that I have been kind of reading on and looking at the most, mostly because I've been studying Ragnarok, and Götterdämmerung is German for the Twilight of the Gods. But anyway,
Ragnarok is the Norse apocalypse, right?
Yes, Ragnarok is the Norse apocalypse in which all the world shall perish in water and fire, and all the gods shall die.
Wow.
Well, that's fun.
But it's considered a cycle because not everyone dies. Two humans are left alive by hiding in the world tree Yggdrasil, and they repopulate the earth. And that's why it's a cycle, is the whole thing happens again. But anyway... There are two fun things about Götterdämmerung that, one, you might know, I knew it before, but it is a fun fact, and the other one genuinely surprised me. Have you ever heard the saying, like, I'm going to start a phrase, I want to see if you can finish it, in opera, it's not over until...
The fat lady sings.
Yes.
The fat lady sings is a reference to Götterdämmerung. It comes specifically from these four operas. The very last thing that happens in Wagner's Ring Cycle is the Valkyrie, Brunhilde, lights a pyre and throws herself into it and has this grand finale where she sings and dies. And then the whole world catches on fire and everyone dies.
Is she fat?
All of the gods is yeah.
Okay. Can I add an additional fun fact that I know?
What?
It's not over till the fat lady sings might be referencing Brynhild's finale, mm-hmm. but it was originally said by a baseball announcer about a baseball game.
Really?
Uh-huh. Yes.
That's hilarious. I had no clue.
That's the only context I know it in is baseball games.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Okay, go on.
So the other fact about, and I haven't actually checked this with all four of the plays, but at very least Götterdämmerung. Okay, so this is a play that's about, you know, Siegfried, or, you know, Sigmund, as I generally know him, and the Valkyries, you got Brunhilde, you got the gods, Odin is involved, Ragnarok comes, the whole thing. Where do you think that it takes place? Like, where is it set? The parts that occur in Earth.
Germany?
Where do you think it's set?
Norway?
Norway?
Germany?
Closer. It's set, actually, in the Kingdom of the Burgundians and the Rhine River.
Why?
France? Why?
Yeah. Well, not France proper. It's not quite the same Burgundians that were after Joan of Arc or anything like that. The Kingdom of the Burgundians in around the 4th century was actually more the area of Switzerland. So the Rhine River is part of the eastern border between France and western Germany.
Okay.
And the northern border of Switzerland. And then the Kingdom of the Burgundians is a little further south around where current-day Geneva is. But it's really close to Italy. It's in the Alps, which really surprised me. I was expecting, like you, this to be, like, Norway or some... Like, the same area that Beowulf occurs in. So Beowulf is set in Sweden and on the island of Zealand in Denmark, around Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this, and mind, this is a German telling of a Norse myth. but it's set more in the area of Switzerland, so pretty far south. And the Rhine River, which flows, I'm going to say somewhere like northern, it's around, I don't know if it actually goes to Amsterdam, but around Amsterdam, goes south through Germany, through like Dusseldorf and near Frankfurt, and then down on the French border to end up in northeastern Switzerland. In the, what is that called? The Lake Constance, I think. Anyway, it's that area. And I was genuinely surprised by that.
Why?
I just found it really interesting. Because, you don't think of Norse myth being in Switzerland and near Italy.
Yeah, I would think at least it would be more like a self-insert, like, yeah, this definitely happened in Berlin.
No, the Rhine River is actually really important to Norse myth, and I thought that was just really, really interesting. Because I think it tells us a lot about where these people moved from. They obviously moved from more northern lands through places like the Netherlands and down the rivers. They didn't just stay in the coastland. They had boats that could go down rivers, and so they did until they found more mountains in the Alps.
That's fascinating.
Huh. Yeah. So there's lots of little peoples that lived around here. Let's see. I've got another map that's just the peoples of the area. So you got, this is in the 4th century. Now, mind, obviously the poem wasn't written in the 4th century, but it's set in the 4th century. And so you've got, like, not only do you got the Norse, the Swedes, the Gates, the Danes, the Angles, the Saxons, but also the Burgundians, who, like I said, are what's important to the play, some of the Franks, and a couple people I'd never even heard of before in that area.
Who?
So yeah, it was really fun to kind of study this, the relationship between Norse and German stuff, and it's really different, because, like, half of this is going to be, as coming from, like, the Eddas, which are real old, and then half of what is coming from more modern interpretations, like Wagner. But it all kind of comes together for how we think of Norse myth.
Who were the people that you'd never heard of?
Chatti? Chatti?
The Chatti. Interesting.
I've never heard of them either.
Yeah, they're kind of mid-Germany.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, and then the Frisians. I forgot about them.
The Frisians?
I've heard of them. Yeah, anyway. I briefly mentioned I'm studying a lot of this because I'm going to write a tabletop campaign that's set in these kind of lands.
And I'm so going to really play fun. It.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out what kind of armor was available in the 4th century to people who were not Romans. It's really hard to find, though.
Amazing? Oh, I could play a Roman.
I want to play.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, I could. You're the DM here. I should let you make that decision. But yeah, I could. Thank you so much for all of you for your fun facts. I've learned so much today. So thank you for joining us for our fun facts episode. Hey, Cleo, do you have listener mail for us?
Well, we got a nice email from our listener Christian, who was replying to my statement that if I ever become a professor, I'm going to have a weird mix of life experience because of places.
Would you like to learn about history and also how to melt gold?
Yes, and he said that if I did do such a thing, I should call the class Crusades and Crucibles.
That's very good.
So thank you, Christian, for naming a future college course. You are welcome to come back and audit it whenever you like.
Thanks, Christian.
But yeah, that's our listener mail. People should send us more because we like it.
You can always send us listener mail at theliberalarnts@gmail.com, or you can contact us on Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter as theliberalarnts. I think we're just liberal_arnts on Twitter. Yeah, what are we going to talk about for our next episode?
We are going to continue working our way back to the history of Turkey via the history of medieval Islam. Next time, we're going to talk about the Abbasid Empire in Iraq and how that gave birth to the Ottoman Empire. We're also going to talk about robots.
Nice!
What? I'm into it! Oh, I'm so into it! Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Please join us for that. Thank you for listening. We also want to thank Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and logo, and Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our music. And until next time, learn something worth knowing.